Everyone, I'm going to open today's session of the House Revenue Committee. Chair Butler has been called away, and so I am holding forth today. We have another number of things on our agenda, and because a couple of members are going to be a little late, I'm going to open with public hearings instead of the work sessions. If any members should have to leave before we go to work sessions, would you need to alert me, because I would like you here for work sessions. So I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3453 today. Mary, I believe you're in the hot seat on this one. House Bill 3453, exempts from property tax any tangible or intangible property whose use arises between qualified governmental entities and energy marketing companies. A qualified government entity is a public body defined by ORS 174.109, which basically states pertains to state government bodies, local government bodies, and special government bodies. Applies to tax years beginning on or after 2006. This House bill was initiated actually back during interim session as an LC, but has come forward by PPM Marketing. It was put forward by them, by that company, because of a tax court decision that is currently under appeal. In the case of PPM versus the Department of Revenue, the tax court ruled in the department's favor with respect to a property tax assessment of roughly $900,000 for tax year 2002. The assessment was based upon the DOR's position that PPM's use of tangible and intangible real or personal property owned by a qualified government entity was subject to tax. PPM is appealing the case because the tax court ruled that the contracts between PPM and the governmental entity had a value that represented the intangible property that was subject to property tax under current law, irrespective of whether the contracts conveyed a possessory interest in the property. Under current law, centrally assessed property can be both tangible and intangible property, and government-owned property is exempt from property tax. However, when the city of Klamath Falls contracted with PPM and transferred rights to this entity to use its real and personal property, the DOR's position was that the exemption status of the property was not transferable to the non-governmental entity that contracted to use it. Therefore, that's an error there. That shouldn't be House Bill 2047. It's this bill, 3453. Will confer this exemption on PPM and other qualified energy marketing companies. Since HB 3453 is not retroactive, it will not have a negative revenue impact for FY 0507 that is attributable to the loss of previous liabilities, but it will have a future impact. And that impact is based on current data from the Department of Revenue in the case that we've discussed. It's in tax report, and it would roughly be $1.9 million in 0507 and $2.4 million in the future by then.
Thank you, Mary. Members of the committee, do you have questions of Mary? This should have a familiar ring. Representative Boquist.
Yes, Madam Speaker. You're not there yet.
No.
House Bill 2047 is the other one that has the familiar ring. Is that correct?
That is correct. Further questions of staff? In that case, I'd like to ask Sean Miller to come up, and Bill Linden can join if you wouldn't mind, in the interest of time. Oh, and Norm Ross.
Yes.
I see the name now. Thank you. Welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller here today on behalf of PPM Energy. As Mary indicated, just a brief history on House Bill 3453. Obviously, we're here in support of House Bill 3453. The bill originally was pre-session filed as 2047 by the Interim House Revenue Committee. When that particular bill was printed, and actually it was printed on the first day of session, we continued our discussion with the Department of Revenue We drafted an amendment that came in on our first hearing, which was a couple months ago on 2047. And if you would recall, at that time, the amendment actually did not fit the relating clause. And so therefore, the product that you see before you, 3453, is the identical bill with the amendment that we worked on with the Department of Revenue to handle our specific interest in the Klamath Falls facility and its relationship with PPM Energy. But I will note before I turn it over to Norm, just to refresh the committee's minds of a couple months ago, the only change that is in the bill, again, it's identical language with one change, and that is on page 2, line 36 of the bill, when we define qualified government entities. If you recall, House Bill 2047 had the federally recognized Indian tribal language in there. This bill does not have that as a language and as a qualified government entity. My understanding, Madam Chair, is that if you remember from the last hearing, the tribes talked about prospective issues or things that they might have. I believe, and I obviously do not speak for the tribes, but my understanding is that they're working through those issues with the Department of Revenue and having those discussions. And so until they have those discussions, we're moving forward with our particular bill. And that's what you have before you in the House Bill 3453. At this time, I'd like to just turn it over to Norm Ross, the property tax manager for Pacific Fort. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Norman Ross. As Sean indicates, I am the property and revenue tax manager for Pacific Corp, which is the rate-regulated electric utility. I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 3453 on behalf of one of our affiliates, which is PPM Energy. Just to refresh your memory, I'll just review a few of my comments from our earlier meeting. I suppose it's 2 months ago now. This bill was drafted in a narrow fashion to address a very narrow assessment issue. And that assessment issue arose because of the assessment issued by the Department of Revenue to PPM Energy in connection with the contracts that PPM Energy has with the City of Klamath Falls to buy power from its electric generating facility. It does have some other contracts providing management of the facility and some other contracts, but it's primarily the assessment is driven by the portion of purchase power that PPM Energy is contracted to buy from the city-owned facility. So this assessment that the department has issued involves a commodity supply contract, not unlike if you were to buy contract to buy a certain amount of apples from an apple orchard or any number of other commodities. So this is a purchase power agreement that the department has assessed. We believe that this assessment of this commodity is fundamentally unfair. The department has not acted to assess similarly situated taxpayers for similar contracts, particularly purchase power agreements. We also believe that the assessment represents a matter of poor tax policy because it distinctly goes after the assessment of an intangible contract right separate from the ownership of physical property, which is a new extension, as I understand it, from the department's historical practices. So this is a policy matter that the department has pursued, and we believe that it's not an appropriate path that they're on. So this legislation seeks to alter that. I don't know that I'll belabor the point. I think we talked about these issues during our last session before you. I might point out a couple of other items, though. First off, the counties are specifically Klamath County is likely to testify before you that they are opposed to this bill, and to suggest perhaps that, in fact, they are entitled to the tax revenues. The fact of the matter is that they did not expect those tax revenues in any shape or form because this assessment was issued at the last minute. I was notified personally probably about 3 days before the assessment was issued that the department intended to pursue this new assessment theory, if you will. Secondly, I might point out, just as a clarification of some of the lead-in for the bill, is, and that is that the department itself, there has been a Oregon tax court case which was adverse to PPM. The department itself disagrees with that decision. They've used the term in their appeal or in their reply brief to the Oregon Supreme Court that they believe the decision was right, but for the wrong reason. So they, the department, even disagrees with the basis on which the Oregon Tax Court judge found on in their favor. So just to clarify those couple of points. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer those at this time.
Questions for Mr. Ray?
No, thank you. Mr. Lynn, did you have?
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Madam Chair, for the record, Bill Linden representing the City of Klamath Falls, and I'm just going to add a couple short observations. This is what we intended to do from the very beginning. It's a narrow bill addressing the issues down in Klamath Falls revolving around the commodity contract with PPM. But to give you a couple of historical perspectives on how this issue came before you, I was involved in the legislation that authorized the City of Klamath Falls to build this cogeneration facility. And I can guarantee you in those discussions, the issue of taxation of this type of a contract never arose. And secondly, once that legislation was effective, this facility is sited in an enterprise zone. Had there been any notion whatsoever that there was going to be a taxation issue with the commodity contract, the city could have very easily, quickly, and painlessly exercise the option that's presented under the statutes relating to enterprise zones to gain a tax exemption down that avenue. So this was clearly a surprise. We think this is a reasonable response to that surprise, and would strongly urge your favorable consideration of House Bill 3453.
Thank you, Mr. Lennon. Questions, Representative Olson?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I do. Actually, it could be for any one of you three. I'm just kind of curious, are there any other relationships like this, government, private sector, anywhere else, other states around the country, that you've kind of modeled this after or anything like that that's going on?
That this bill has been modeled after or that the assessment practice?
Right.
There are no doubt other situations where there's private public partnerships of this type. I can't think of a specific instance, but I'm not aware of any instance where a state taxing agency has acted to assess purely the contract rights apart from the physical ownership of physical property. Now, the department asserts that they have that right. There's several administrative challenges to actually doing that in the right way. But this is the only state that I'm aware of that has extended the tax base to capture this type of a transaction.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Did I understand from your testimony that this is essentially the original bill,
Madam
except
Chair,
for
yeah, members of the committee, Sean Miller again, PPM Energy. The bill 3453 was the House Bill 2047 with the dash one amendment that we had at the first hearing, absent the definition of a qualified government entity, the federally recognized tribe. And so that's the only issue that is not in,
okay,
in the bill.
And this came out of a LC draft that was submitted for the by the committee?
Madam Chair, yes, it did.
And the language is the same?
Yes, it is.
Thank you. Any further questions of this panel for those coming in 9-0? Gil Rydell from AOC is signed up. Gil, if you'd come forward.
Madam Chair.
Welcome.
Thank you. In order to save time, Mike Long, the Klamath County Treasurer, Tax Collector, and Budget and Fiscal Officer, who has local knowledge of this issue, is with me and will be able to answer specific local questions. I am now having distributed there by your staff my comments from AOC, Association of Counties. For the record, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties.
Thank you.
Our governing body, which represents county officials statewide, met yesterday and voted unanimously to oppose this bill for the following reasons. The bill was not written to be limited to this specific situation. But even if it were so limited, this amounts to an unnecessary property tax expenditure in Klamath County of just short of $1 million for taxes to be collected in this fiscal year for shared state and local services. In effect, schools and the state school fund are being told to pay a private energy marketing firm over $650,000 in the 05-07 biennium of K-12 resources. To become law, a proposal for a new property tax exemption, in effect an expenditure of public funds, should satisfy the test of being a compelling state public interest of immediate need and by agreement of affected local jurisdictions, and none of these have been demonstrated by proponents. Since this bill applies to all private public agreements, it would break new policy ground. Now, we recognize that times are changing in the regulated energy sector. But to change policy in response to a very specific situation that applies more broadly in the bill without fully considering the nuances and broader application is an open invitation to significant unintended consequences. You might consider instead a more thoughtful approach this interim to examine the changing industry as a whole and the appropriate spreading of public service costs of public services. Proponents have mentioned that they have lost their appeal in tax court. If you let the Supreme Court act, you will have the benefit of Supreme Court's decision and full briefing on the meaning and shortcomings of the law. I think Madam Chair, Mike Long could give now a local perspective on this and some background.
Mr. Long.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, committee members. Klamath County is opposed to House Bill 3453. Holding the county knew there was a partnership between the City of Klamath Falls and PPM Energy based on articles reported in the local newspaper. I reviewed the tax laws and knew there would not be any tax on the city property, but in interpreting the laws there, I saw that there was a potential tax on the intangible value on the PPM Energy share of the contract. I did not know what the value would be until the assessor finalized the tax rules. I anticipated a growth in value and estimated, as I was preparing the revenue projections for the county from the property taxes for the county budget. And then when the assessor sent the report to all the districts, the taxes that would be received from tax collection for the year, and then all the little districts in that used this and assumed that they would be received. I got notice from the tax court that PPM Energy was appealing the property taxes. The value was 0.25% of the assessed value of the county. The tax court advised me to consider reserving those taxes until the suit was settled. So I evaluated and used prudent management and got authorization from the Board of County Commissioners to reserve the funds and not distribute to the taxing districts until the court case is settled. If PPM Energy wins the case, districts will have to pay an additional 12% interest on the taxes that are paid. By reserving these taxes, I received a number of complaints from a number of the districts for withholding their share of the funds. The county and the districts budgeted for their share of the property taxes based on the assessor's report. Just have not received this as of date until the court case is settled one way or the other. The taxes for the 2004-2005 were $930 with the $1,000 and small dollars with the discount. or for biennium would be $1,860,000 plus, which includes the share that goes to the schools in Klamath County. The state will have to make up the lost taxes for the schools under the state formula from the state general fund.
Questions?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Boquist.
Gail, first, would you, thank you, Madam Chair, would you define unnecessary property tax expenditure?
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, I'm suggesting that based on what I would consider three solid standards for new property tax expenditures, that there's a compelling statewide public interest, that it's of immediate need, and that there's agreement with the local jurisdictions. And none of this has been demonstrated.
So what you're saying is not collecting the tax is now an expenditure. Is that what you're saying?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, they were taxed under current law. It's been tested to this point at the tax court. If these taxes are not collected, it would be an expenditure, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm. We'll follow up, Madam
Chair. Go ahead.
Question for you, Mike. I'm trying to understand the logic behind this, and you may not know the answer, because we've got the Department of Revenue involved in this, and we got Klamath County involved in this. And the Department of Revenue is in court. I'm assuming, based on your discussion, that Klamath County is a principal party in this lawsuit in how to define intangible property. So how did you come about, I still don't understand, how you came about determining that an intangible contract owned by a city entity in your county was now taxable, and then when, at what point did the Oregon Department of Revenue get involved, at which point did we go down the tax court thing? So I can understand the sequence here. Thank you. Yeah.
Madam Chairman, Representative Boquist, Klamath County, my involvement is, as a tax collector, I try to stay on the laws and try to understand the language. And looking at it, I saw that there was a potential. So when I'm making my projections, I assume that there would be some assessed value possibly. But the COGEN is a centrally assessed taxes by the Department of Revenue. So they do the assessment, and then those numbers are sent down to the county assessor, which puts them on the rolls, and then the taxes are collected. How that rolled in there. When I'm trying to project and foresee a forecast for revenue, I have to look at all those different things. That was one of the items that I looked at, that there's a potential of an intangible up there. I didn't know what the value would be or the taxes, but I took that would play into the role when I was making my projections.
Yes.
So I fully understand. So the county of Klamath, you representing the county of Klamath, initiated the action and then advised Department of Revenue. You believe this was taxable? Is that what we're saying here?
No, sir. Okay. No, sir. It comes from the state. Any centrally assessed property, and that's anything, I think it's over $1 million or $5 million, the Department of Revenue does the assessment, and they advise us that of the value. And in studying the pillar, I assumed there was a potential of the intangible.
Still having a challenge here. So the Department of Revenue advised you that this could possibly be intangible, could be taxed, and then of course you assessed it and put it in your forecast. Is that what you're saying?
That's what they worked with the county assessor. I'm the tax collector. All I do is I collect. You know, as a budget officer, I was conferring with the assessor.
Madam Chair.
Follow up. I'm trying to figure out the stage here, because I mean, this committee is going to take some action if we take any, and I'm assuming that the county of Klamath at least has some sort of relationship with the city, some sort of working relationship, and that would you assume the city, if they thought it was taxable, would have contacted you? Or I mean, explain the relationship, because you said somebody saw it in the newspaper, was the first time you saw it.
Well, we knew the plant was being built, and of course we know that municipal property is not taxable. And then the article come out on the on the story of the contract between them, the commissioners, the Board of County Commissioners, and the City Council, that they try to at least meet quarterly, or they meet and confer, and I don't know what they discuss there. I was just looking at it when I was advised by my board as the tax collector and to advise commissioners.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Further questions?
Madam Chair, may I just clarify one point?
No, by all means.
Okay. The appropriate procedure, as I understand it, for centrally assessed utility is that the assessments made by Department of Revenue, Department of Revenue distributes among the counties the appropriate proportions of that assessment and the taxable value. And so the assessor would receive that from the Department of Revenue. So it may be appropriate person to ask some questions is the department. I might also say that the one of the commissioners told me at one point that they had not had conversations about this specific item with the city, and that was one of the problems they were having locally.
Okay. Gil, in your written remarks, you talk about the fact that you don't believe this is a self-limiting enough language in this bill. Do you know of any other qualified government entity and energy marketing company that this would apply to?
That's a very good question, Madam Chair. This bill, of course, would be, if it's passed into law, it would be on the books and would apply henceforth until amended. Let's say, for example, the City of Portland acquired PGE and needed private help to run it. You could have this apply to that directly.
Okay. You don't know of any others currently?
I do not.
Okay. Further questions? Okay. I think you're off the hook. I'm going to... seeing no one else signed up and no one else rushing out to speak on this, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3453 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3454. Mary, you want to talk about this one?
House Bill 3454 exempts from property tax tangible and intangible property rights related to Pacific Northwest AC intertie as referenced between the U.S. Department of Energy and any city of any state. It applies to tax years beginning whenever these agreements were executed or beginning on or after 2005, July 1. Two city-owned entities that are electricity producers located outside of Oregon are subject to property tax that has been imposed on both tangible and intangible properties. However, the way this particular bill is written with the word rights, property rights, as has been explained to me by the Department of Revenue staff, the language is so restrictive that it would not it would have no impact because they don't assess just the rights, they look at the property. And so in order for this bill to have a revenue impact, there would have to be an amendment, which has been proposed, not by you, it's just been suggested so far, that they would exclude the word property, exclude the word rights, and at that point the revenue impact would be based on data that I've gotten from the Department of Revenue so far. Basically, what's happening here is that on April 1st, well, let me read you the background on it, continuing with what I said. The two city-owned entities are in a dispute with the Department of Revenue over a tax liability. The court has ruled in favor of the department, which asserted that these properties are taxable because the companies hold a possessory interest in the intertie. The taxable property includes towers, lines, transformers, substations, and publicly owned but privately used or used by a taxable corporation. On April 1st, the court postponed considering whether imposing Oregon's property tax assessment was a violation of the Supremacy Clause. I think that means basically the federal legislation regarding whether or not you can tax entities that are out of state. and whether that's even legal constitutionally. Both parties requested the postponement of their oral presentations until the legislature decided whether or not it wished to create an exemption that would be retroactive. If so, then this case wouldn't proceed in tax court. The contested assessments in arrears, if the amendment is proposed and accepted, which excludes that word rights, would be roughly $3.8 million for the non-recurring piece that is retroactive, and more, of course, for the annual amount.
Okay, questions of Mary? We have some testifiers here. If you want to come up in a panel, John DiLorenzo, John Cameron, Jim Smith, that would be time.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm a partner with the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, and I'm here on behalf of my clients, the City of Seattle and the City of Tacoma, Washington. With me today are two of my law partners. To my left, to your right, is Mr. John Cameron. He's chairman of our Portland Energy Group. And then to my right, your left, is Mr. Jim Smith, who is handling the current litigation between the Department of Revenue and our clients, the cities of Seattle and Tacoma. They're here to answer any questions you may have. We are here in support of House Bill 3454 and the Dash 1 Amendment, which is attached at the back of our testimony for your review. Both the cities of Seattle and Tacoma have municipal electric utility departments, much like the cities of Eugene and Springfield. These municipal utilities are not operated for profit. Instead, they are departments within their respective city governments, and they provide electric service to the citizens and businesses within those cities. Seattle's electric department is called Seattle City Light. Tacoma's department is referred to as Tacoma Power. Neither Seattle City Light nor Tacoma Power serve any customers whatsoever in Oregon. Neither owns any physical property whatsoever in the state of Oregon. The cities of Seattle and Tacoma each own hydroelectric generating stations, which are located in Washington. The output of these hydro facilities is combined with the wholesale power contracts that they each have, principally from DPA, to serve the electrical needs of their customers. As with any hydro facility, the output of the Seattle and Tacoma hydro plants varies, often hour to hour, depending on the rainfall, flood control measures, and the amount of water that must be released to facilitate migration of salmon through the affected watersheds. This natural and man-made variability can swing the power supplies of Seattle and Tacoma from surplus to deficit and back to surplus over very short periods of time. Utilities in California will often purchase Northwest surplus electricity and will sell electricity back during times of energy shortage in the Northwest. This California market allows Seattle and Tacoma to balance their power supplies in Washington with the demands of their municipal customers. Much of this power flows over the transmission network of the BPA, which owns about 75% of the transmission facilities within the Northwest. BPA offers electric transmission service to every utility in the Northwest. All transmission lines connecting the Northwest to California are owned by the BPA, Portland General Electric, and PacifiCorp. These three utilities individually own a variety of alternating current transmission lines and substations, which are all operated together and are known as the Pacific Northwest AC Intertie. That system is pursuant to a set of agreements that date back to the 60s between them, and it is an overall transmission system. Seattle and Tacoma each have contracts with the U.S. Department of Energy for the use of the intertie, but have no right whatsoever in any particular facilities. Although the Department of Revenue was aware in 1995 that Seattle and Tacoma had intertie contracts with the BPA, it did not assess Seattle or Tacoma until 2001. When it sought retroactively to assess each city back to the year 1995, claiming that this situation qualified as omitted property under the Oregon's omitted property statute. By including retroactive assessments, the department attempted to assess the citizens and ratepayers of Seattle and Tacoma approximately $5,600,000. Neither Seattle nor Tacoma have paid one dime of this tax. Instead, each has challenged the department's assessment by filing for relief in the Oregon Tax Court, and we've listed the tax court number in our testimony. ORS 307.090 exempts city property from taxation. This statute has been construed to apply to cities located in this state. The Department of Revenue is attempting to tax Seattle and Tacoma only because they are located outside of this state, outside the state of Oregon. Yet to be decided by the tax court judge is our assertion that this disparate tax treatment of Oregon versus in-state versus out-of-state cities constitutes unlawful discrimination under the Commerce Clause to the United States Constitution. We also have defenses regarding the Supremacy Clause, which legislative revenue staff has briefed you on. If we prevail on the Commerce Clause issue, the tax court will have two basic options. First, the judge could eliminate the discrimination by including Seattle or Tacoma within the ambit of 307.090, or what I believe is a more likely consequence, one that comports with past tax decisions, is that the court would completely invalidate the exception as to all cities, both inside the state and outside of the state. In other words, this tax court litigation could put at risk the property tax exemptions now enjoyed by Oregon cities. If the tax court so rules, it could create a crisis for Oregon cities and for the legislature. Although the case was set for trial this month, the tax court, at the request of the parties, including the Department of Revenue, has postponed the trial pending the outcome of this legislation. In other words, the court and the parties are now waiting for your policy determination as to what the proper scope of 307.090 should be. House Bill 3454, as amended by the Dash 1 Amendment, will eliminate the discrimination between Oregon and out-of-state cities by exempting any tangible or intangible property interests, property rights, or property related to the Pacific Northwest AC intertie, which is referenced by a written agreement between the party and the Department of Energy. And it is limited to a contract between the Department of Energy and a city of any state. The exemption will apply to tax years beginning on or after the date of the agreement. Now, there are only five entities with these types of contracts which relate to the intertie. House Bill 3454 will not affect the tax status of any contract signatory other than Seattle and Tacoma. Two of the other entities, privately owned Power Resources Cooperative and Puget Sound Energy, Inc., are paying taxes and are not challenging the tax before the tax court. That is because they are private entities. And if they were located in Oregon or Washington, they would be assessed property tax. The fifth, Snohomish Public Utility District, is a Washington public utility district currently challenging the Department of Revenue's assessment in the tax court on a number of grounds, I think including the supremacy issue. Snohomish is not covered by House Bill 3454 because it is not a city. Our legislation would not affect Snohomish's right to challenge the Department of Revenue's assessment before the tax court. It would leave that circumstance as is. Madam Chair and members, we urge your committee to send this bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation for a number of reasons. First, enactment of the legislation will treat in-state cities fairly by providing them the very same tax treatment that in-state cities. So it'll take, it will treat out-of-state cities fairly by giving them the same tax treatment as in-state cities currently enjoy with respect to the intertie. No local government, secondly, is currently dependent on any tax revenue generated from the city of Tacoma or the city of Seattle with respect to the intertie. There is not one local government that can come forth and say they have grown dependent on this flow of revenue and this legislation will cost them anything. Neither Seattle nor Tacoma have paid Oregon property tax in the past. Passage of the bill will not generate a refund of any sort whatsoever. Third, the state of Washington does not tax intangible contract rights at all. Any rights that would be held by Oregon entities in Washington would not be subject to property tax. And fourth, from time to time, state legislatures attempt to tax residents in border states in a discriminatory manner. These attempts quite often then invite retaliation by the border states. Passage of this bill would send a welcome signal to the state of Washington
that Oregon has no intention of treating out-of-state cities in a discriminatory way. Now, late yesterday, Mr. Riddell gave me the courtesy of telephoning me and informing me that the Association of Oregon Counties is opposed to this bill because it might limit an opportunity for their member counties to generate revenue. It's my understanding, and of course they'll speak for themselves, but it's my understanding that they're opposed despite the fact that none of them have ever collected these taxes, that in-state cities would never be assessed these taxes, that Washington does not tax intangibles at all, and that the Department of Revenue might well lose in the tax court anyway. Madam Chair and members, it is our view that our tax policy should be logically driven. It should be non-discriminatory. It should not be driven by an insatiable thirst for revenue, no matter where derived and no matter what the consequence. Madam Chair, I thank you and the committee for your interest in this issue. Mr. Cameron and Mr. Smith and I are available to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. DiLorenzo. Questions? Representative Galizio.
I had a question about, you mentioned in 1995 the Department of Revenue knew about the intertie but didn't attempt to. Can you just talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, I can. Madam Chair, Representative Galizio, in 1995, the Department of Revenue did assess one of the private parties in the intertie agreement. It's our information that they were also aware of Seattle's and Tacoma's. They tried a case in the tax court with respect to that private party. They prevailed as against the private party. And so that tax court case established that the private party, in fact, owed tax because it was a private party.
Okay.
But they did not proceed against the city of Seattle or Tacoma.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Is there any scenario you can imagine in which someone should pay for that right to use that intertie?
Madam Co-Chair and Representative Haas, that's a larger policy question than the one, frankly, presented here. Our main concern is that there be uniformity in the manner in which cities are treated. If all cities were required to pay tax, that would be one thing. On the other hand, in Oregon, cities do not pay property tax on property, intangible rights, intangible property. They just don't pay tax whatsoever with respect to property. To tax out an out-of-state city merely by virtue of its location is not a good policy decision, in our view. It invites retaliation, and it probably offends the Commerce Clause, and it could give rise to a whole host of problems, including the potential invalidation of the exemption, which then would cause in-state cities to have to pay property tax. Whether or not the intertie should be taxed for all is a matter that, frankly, I haven't really given a lot of thought to, so I'm sorry, I don't have a view on that issue.
That's Dr. Chiller.
Thank you.
Doesn't happen very often.
Any further questions?
And thank you very much, gentlemen, and we'll ask Gil Rydell to come up again and talk to us.
Thank you once again, Madam Chair. For the record, Gil Rydell, Association of Oregon Counties. I'm just going to pause a moment until you have I have another one pager. I think it'd be helpful to have that in front of you. Yesterday, our statewide policy setting board voted unanimously to oppose this bill, and I have reasons too. The cities of Seattle and Tacoma are subject in Oregon to taxes on intangible and tangible property they hold here. They hold a contract, in effect, an ownership, to use the intertie to wheel power through our state for sale in California. And that means that right is taxable. Now, Washington does not tax intangibles. They have a different system. They tax sales. We do not tax sales. They have a business and occupation tax. We do not. Our system is different from theirs, so the fact that we tax different things than they do is something to be discussed, I think, in a larger context. Second point is Oregon need not and should not give competitive advantages to cities in Washington State. They're in the business of marketing their power for profit and sending it to California
through our state. Nothing prevents Seattle City Light or Tacoma Power from asking enough return from sales to cover their tax liabilities. The Department of Revenue reports that the taxes in dispute are significant, some $3.8 million across 11 counties. Most of that will go to education. Given the challenges you face with school finance, it seems inappropriate to grant a new property tax expenditure that benefits only out-of-state business enterprises. There's no compelling statewide public interest, immediate need, or agreement from affected local jurisdictions. There's also no need for the committee to argue the points at issue in appeal. You've heard arguments about the Commerce Clause and about invalidation of in-state exemptions for municipalities. Those are before the court. At least the first item is before the court. It's hard to imagine that the tax court would act immediately to invalidate anything with the prospect of an appeal to the Supreme Court to follow. The legislature, so the court has the opportunity to look at these issues in depth, and we recommend that you let them do that. The legislature, you on the other hand, make choices of statewide policy, and AOC urges you to leave the law the way it is and to continue to tax property held in Oregon by out-of-state enterprises. That's the extent of my remarks, Madam Chair.
Representative Riley has a question.
Thank you. Gil, is it your opinion that cities inside the state of Oregon should be taxed on enterprises and profit-making enterprises?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Riley, I hadn't thought that through. I expect that if there is a profit-making operation, that there is tax liability involved. I would ask the Department of Revenue to clarify that.
What about the Klamath Falls? That's a profit-making enterprise, isn't it?
Madam Chair, Representative Riley, the ownership of that facility by the city is not taxable. I understand that.
And it's your opinion that it should not be, or it should be?
It should not be.
Okay. Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Raydell, for your remarks. Without anyone else rushing up here to speak on this issue.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Seems like we should hear from the Department of Revenue.
Yes, I agree.
John Phillips from the Department of Revenue?
I don't know if he can speak to this, but...
He took a pass the last time he was invited. I'll invite him again.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. Are there questions I could answer or clarify?
Well, John, I don't mean to put you on the spot. I don't know if this was your sole decision to do this, but I think we'd like to, you know, see the reasoning as to why this, if it was known that this was an issue some years ago, and then to assess this tax after that, and just to why, what the reasoning is.
Okay, Madam Chair, Representative Hass, there are a lot of issues that have been raised, and that is one of them. I'd be happy to make an attempt to speak to them. I'd like to start by saying that this bill really, in our opinion, the Department's opinion is that it presents a straightforward policy decision. Do you want to tax municipalities of other states the same as you tax municipalities in Oregon? Aside from that, we think your policy is that you do currently, and that's why we're pursuing these cases. The Department has been, I don't want to say accused, but identified as pursuing this aggressively, and we are doing that because we think that's what you want us to do. Now, if that's not what you want us to do, you know, that please let us know, and please do it through legislation. To answer your question, we don't take assessments lightly, and so if we're not aware of property, of course we wouldn't assess it. If we're aware of property and we're unclear whether or not it's taxable, we have to make a reasoned decision whether or not to pursue it. Sometimes this involves lengthy discussions with the Department of Justice, the parties involved. I think the people that have testified here today have described different situations about the same property. You've got privately owned companies like that have property interests in the intertie. You've got public entities that have interests. You've got investor-owned that have interests. And we think that does bring a little bit of a different character Under Oregon law, it does. If you look in line 7 of the bill, it refers to public entities using property intended for corporate purpose. So at some point, a decision, even in the situation of Klamath Falls or other ones, for a school district that has property that it's leasing out to a farmer because they're not ready to use it. If they're not using it for their corporate purpose, then we have to make a decision, and the county assessors in some cases have to make a decision about what your policy is in the application of specific property. So I cannot speak, Representative Haas, to exactly what happened in 95, what the deliberations were. I can look into that and get back to you, but I think what it was, first of all, it was an awareness issue, and then it was an analysis issue.
Thank you.
Further questions, Representative Boquist?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I mean, I have a question, but it's a takeaway, because I'm not going to have an answer for it, if you'll indulge me. I would like to know, in regards to 3454, 3453, have you come back and tell us how much the Department of Revenue has spent tracking down these intangibles in Klamath County, in Seattle and Tacoma, so on and so forth, in terms of how much staff, how much legal costs, have we been in court, we're in appeals court, everything else, on this whole intangible property tax? Because those are the larger issues in intangible property tax. And we're literally pitting citizen against citizen, city against county, state against state. And so, to me, Madam Chair, I'd like them to come back and better explain this, because we have a series of bills, and say, you know, how much money are we spending, and what are we doing chasing this? And is it really good public policy to do so? And I think we really have not effectively heard from the Department of Revenue, Madam Chair.
I would suggest the public policy question is one for this body.
Right, Madam Chair, but I would suggest that they have spent a considerable amount of money interpreting this.
Mr. Phillips, do you understand what he's asking?
Madam Chair, I think I understand what he's asking, but I'm not sure if it's... You want me to actually do an analysis of how much we've spent for over how many years? And
10 years.
What would you like to know?
Representative Boquist?
We're obviously in two legal pending cases, Madam Chair, and so we've spent a considerable amount of money, and the question from a public policy point of view on intangible property is it costing us more to go collect this, if it is fact public policy, than what we're going to get from it?
I think I understand, Representative Boquist, what you're asking for, and we will discuss, you know, some of these issues. I think I understand that you're making a statement more than a question here in terms of the cost of trying to figure out these tangibles and intangibles in terms of where they are appropriately taxed or not taxed. And your statement, therefore, is that it's costing us either way. Whether we do it or not, it's costing us in terms of working through the courts and the system, which I think points us to the direction that we do need to make policy statements here and make them clear to the Department of Revenue, if you would indulge me that interpretation of the whole discussion.
You're the chair, Madam Chair.
you want to argue back? Thank you very much. And thank you for this good discussion. Mr. Phillips, if there are no further questions, I am going to close this public hearing on House Bill 3454. I better put on my glasses to get the number right. And if Representative Esquivel would make an appearance in the next few minutes, members of the committee, we've got a number of bills that we've heard in the past that we are going to go to work session on. Pay attention. I'm not probably going to take them exactly in the same order that they are on your on your agenda, but I'm going to be close. So I'm going to start out by opening a work session on House Bill 2197. Mazin, I think, is going to put us in the loop here. This is one, if you recall, regarding the tourism issue from last session, and I was the part of a work group that met and put together some amendments, which I'm sure Mazin's going to talk about. Put you in the pictures. Go ahead, Mazin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, in your packet, you find the dash 4 amendments. And for the Bill 2197, if you recall, last time there was two main issues with the bill that needed to be somehow addressed, and these were the healthcare facilities that was part of the or what was talked about in the dash 2 amendments, and then the nonprofits, the church groups and the camps and the conference centers and so on. That was the subject of several attempts on dash 1, dash 3. And then the dash 4 came to combine both the issues. So you would have in the first six or the first five lines the issue about the healthcare and the facilities of hospitals and so on, and leaves the discretion for the Department of Human Services to license and register these facilities, and therefore they will not be subject to the transient lodging tax. And then the issue of the nonprofit youth or church camp nonprofits, conference centers and so on is addressed from line 6 till the end of the amendment. It's also in section 5 gives the Department of Revenue a rulemaking authority in identifying what is a dwelling unit and what is a non-profit facility and temporary human occupancy. This in order to be able to deal with the issues as they come up and identify them as so. This seems to be the consensus, well, not the consensus yet, I guess, we'll see, but the type of resolution for the issues that we have discussed in the 17th, I believe, of March.
Members of the committee, we are in work session. I think that you understand that the dash 4 amendments basically answer the questions that were in the previous amendments and is somewhat omnibus in that in its intent. We have the folks who've been working on this in the room if there are questions about the original bill or about the amendments. Either Mazin or someone in the room could probably answer them. I am looking for motions.
Madam Chair.
Representative Haas.
I would move the dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2197.
Representative Haas moves the dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2197. Any objections? So moved.
Madam Chair.
Representative Haas.
I would move House Bill 2197 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Haas moves House Bill 2197 as amended with the dash 4 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any objection? So moved. Thank you, Representative Haas, and I will close this public hearing on House Bill work session. This work session on House Bill 2197. Keep me honest here, okay? Thank you. Next one, House. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2089. I keep you up here, Mazin.
Okay, I'm glad to be here, Madam Chair. Again, as a matter of the State Governor's Office.
Oh, I do need a carrier. Do I have to be in work session to get a carrier?
No.
Okay. I think I'll ask Representative Olson to carry this. Thank you.
Okay. Chair, back to House Bill 2089. The House Bill 2089 came to us beginning from the Department of Parks and Recreation. And what it basically, to refresh your memory of what it attempts to do, is to allow for the amounts of collections to accumulate to $100 before they're transferred to local governments and agencies and so on. Now, there was a few suggestions last time when we discussed this bill also on the 17th of March in allowing for private entities to be under the same type of allowance of the $100 accumulation before they remit as well, and that would be sort of streamlining the process altogether. And the second issue that was raised by local governments, that having this as an open-ended type of process might be of a hindrance to the amounts that comes in from several number of entities at less than $100 that could make a lot of money. So the section 2 of the subsection 2 of section 4 of the Dash 1 amendment puts December 31st as a date certain that would instruct whoever is collecting to send whatever they have by that date to the party of the local government that is in question. Now, the two sets of ORSs are being addressed here is one for the parks ORSs that is in the main bill, and then in the amendment ORS 320 and so on that talks about the local lodging tax. So that's why you have some repetition in allowing no assessment of penalty between the House bill and the amendment. That's what the amendment is, Madam Chair.
Questions for Mazin? If you recall this one. Again, there are folks in the room who have been involved in this in the past and would be willing to answer questions. Again, we have amendments.
I have to mention, Madam Chair, that I've sent this amendment to different parties who are interested, and probably the lack of response means that it's okay with this.
I would take that as probably the case.
Madam Chair.
Representative Haas.
I would move Dash 1, House Bill 2089.
Representative Haas moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2089. Any objection? So moved. Representative Haas.
Yes, Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2089 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Madam Chair, this is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Haas, this has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Would you like to?
I would, Madam Chair, move House Bill 2089 as amended, the due pass recommendation to the House Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Haas moves House Bill 2089 as amended with the Dash 1 amendments to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Without objection, so ordered. Thank you. Don't need a carrier on that. Let's get, we've got a couple more members of the committee. I'm going to open a House Bill, this is a work session on House Bill 2776. Mary, you're back on this one, I think. Members of the committee, if you recall, this one was with regard, we heard some testimony on this one on historical property, and it's my understanding that there was a group that was going to get together.
We're still working on some amendments on that.
Okay, let's hear from Mary about that, and then we'll...
This is the
historic purpose, and I believe we had a work group who was to go forth and
And I don't believe we had the output.
We do not have the amendments ready on House Bill 2776, but this bill basically eliminates the sunset date on historical property. Subject to special assessment, expands type of property for which owner may reapply for a second 15-year period of special assessment. After the original public hearing on this bill, the committee recommended that a work group be formed and they would come forth with certain recommendations that would be an amendment to this bill. And those include a number of items which we can discuss when the bill is amended.
Okay. And it's my understanding, Representative Esquivel, that the committee is, or the work group.
Okay. So we get our amendments completed.
Without questions from the committee, I think I will go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 2776 and await their response. And open a work session on House Bill 2511. Yeah, Mary, you want to talk about this one?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Remind us.
House Bill 2511 will add four organizations to the list of fraternal organizations whose property are exempt from property tax subject to certain restrictions which pertain to the definition of a fraternal organization. And the bill also changes the definition of a fraternal organization from one that is a nonprofit established as a lodge system with a ritualistic form of work to one that is established as a service system. Section 2, paragraph 3, subparagraph 3, exempts from property tax any property owned by a fraternal organization that is used exclusively by charitable organizations that qualify for an exemption from federal income tax because of its status as described in 501c3 of the Internal Revenue Code. And it would do so apparently if it's used exclusively by these organizations. So the proposal is that if a fraternal organization owns some property and basically rents it out for the, let's say, entire year, and it's used exclusively by these 501c3s, then and only then would the property be exempt. And it would have to, it no longer requires that the exemption will exist if the property is rented for cost, to recover costs. Under the provisions of this bill, if the rent, it were charged in excess of cost, then that would be exempt as well. So I checked on that last, and when we met on 223, apparently we had several different interpretations of Section 2, paragraph 3. Testimony was provided suggesting that there could be a negative impact. For example, if I were one of the proposed service-related entities and I owned a parking lot, let's say, and I rented it out completely for that year. If I rented it out to a 501c3 qualified entity, under current law, if I rented it at cost, just to recover my costs, it would be exempt. But under the provision, proposed provision, I could rent it for in excess of my cost, and it would still be exempt. So that is what the testimony of Mr. Simmons suggested. And I checked with the General Counsel's office to find out that that clause was intended. Okay, it wasn't an accident. It wasn't an oversight, as was suggested possibly when we met initially on this bill. And so there would be a possible negative impact. But according to the numbers that we derived from the taxes that are paid for the inclusion of four additional names to the statute, the impact totally right now is less than $50,000 per biennium, and I'm not sure that the additional cost would be much more than that if they were renting out a parking lot or something like that to a 501c3, qualified 501c3. So I haven't changed the impact on these numbers. I should also add that during the discussion or the presentation, initially we had testimony requesting that some of the language in the first section of the bill should not be deleted. There was a request that the term ritualistic form of work on line 9 be included, and the testimony presented by Mr. Simmons, I believe, did not have any objection to the inclusion of four more names, to the list, but he had wanted some of the original language retained. And that's basically.
You remember this one?
Yes. And all of you had
affiliations.
Yes, and I believe that we discussed affiliations. Questions from the committee on this one?
We heard discussion about leaving 9 in and elements of line 9 in and elements of line 21, and then I think we heard discussion about deleting everything after 8 and looking and replacing it with another text. Was there any amendment submitted or was there work done on that?
No. Representative Haas?
When you say cost, Mary, who determines what the cost is?
We had this discussion yesterday, and on a different bill, and Chair Butler asked for a clearer definition of what is cost recovery, right? And I'm not an accountant, so I'm not sure how those definitions would apply, but obviously there might be some differences of opinion there.
Sure. I mean,
Representative.
Madam Chair, somebody could have different costs. I mean, it seems like it's a little bit vague.
Okay. You're speaking about the language in that Section 3 thing?
Is that the section?
Yeah.
I had assumed, Representative Haas, that, you know, and it's an assumption, right, that if the property were something like a building that they owed a mortgage on, or they had to make repairs on for maintenance, that those costs would be something they could charge on and recover their costs for if they rented it. But again, the discussion that we had yesterday about a different bill, of course, but it pertained to whether it was incremental costs or total costs.
Well, I think it's important enough, Madam Chair, to pause for a second, because I know that there was one of these groups in Washington County recently sold a golf course for $15 million. So we're not always talking about small little parking lots here and there. I think it's important enough to button it down a little bit better than that. I mean,
Are you willing to work on amendments in some form that would satisfy you in this?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I think that's a good idea. I will... we will not move this bill, and we will look for amendments that would nail down your problems and I will close this work session on House Bill, let's see, that was 2511. Thank you, Mary. And I'm going to open, Representative Boquist, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3359. Mary, remind us, this was yesterday. I think our memories are better on this one.
Yeah, I'm not sure, ma'am.
House Bill 3559 clarifies existing law by exempting from property tax aircraft used or held by foreign-owned carriers. Applies to tax years retroactively beginning on or after July 4th, 2004. Testimony of go through the background again briefly. It just was the same as before. Any aircraft that is required to be, let's drop down to the main issue, which was that the Department of Revenue indicated at this public hearing that the Department of Revenue may have initially issued a notice of assessment to some foreign-owned aircraft and subsequently got an opinion from the Attorney General's office that those taxes should not have been assessed. Okay, and so there is no real tax loss. Prospectively, there might be if you were to decide this was a taxable item, but based on the Attorney General's review, there shouldn't be any tax imposed on foreign-owned aircraft. Testimony provided by the Department of Revenue was accompanied by a letter from the Attorney General to the Department of Revenue that indicated the assessment of property does not apply to aircraft owned by foreign airlines and used solely in international passenger service. Therefore, the House bill, as described by the Department of Revenue a few days ago, was intended merely as a clarification of current law.
Questions from the committee? We are in work session.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Representative Haas. Was that you that said
yes?
You are recognized.
I see no amendments here.
No, there are none.
I would move House Bill 3359 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Haas moves House Bill 3359 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any objection? So moved. I'm looking for a carrier.
Need a 4-0.
Representative Riley had his hand up earlier, Representative Haas, so I'm going to let Representative Riley be assigned the carrier. And I'm going to close this work session on House Bill 3359. And there being nothing further before the committee, I'm going to adjourn this House Revenue Committee for the day.